Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari, and I just want you to know that we've edited this podcast for brevity, so you hear all the good stuff quicker. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In the 1920s, as airplanes were still in their infancy, really, researchers in Louisiana began surveying the skies above the local farm fields, attempting to understand the movement of gypsy moths, cotton bollworm moths, and other insects that had the potential to decimate the state's agriculture. In his stunning book, Insectopedia, author Hugh Raffles explains what happened next. They flew more than 1,300 flights over the course of a few years, capturing insects at varying elevations. Quote, they estimated that at any given time on any given day throughout the year, the air column rising from 50 to 14,000 feet above 1 square mile of Louisiana countryside contained an average of 25 million insects and perhaps as many as 36 million. Raffles goes on, at 15,000 feet, probably the highest elevation at which any specimen has ever been taken above the surface of the earth, at least at that time, they trapped a ballooning spider. End quote. 15,000 feet. Now, the thought of millions and millions of insects in the air around you either fills you with wonder or with horror. But either way, it's amazing. And we still know so little about so many of the insects around us. We're not going to be able to download all the amazing insect information that's out there in the next hour, but we are sure as heck going to try. And to that end, I'm sitting in the Montpelier Bureau with Brian Pfeiffer, a writer and field naturalist and adjunct faculty member in the field naturalist program at UVM, and Kent McFarland, conservation biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies and co-host of VPR's Outdoor Radio. Gentlemen, welcome back. What a pleasure to have you on the Bug Show again.
Hi, Jane. Great to see you.
Super to be here.
Yeah, I love that book, Insectopedia by Hugh Raffles, but I just love that idea. First of all, we didn't fly before, you know, the early 1900s, so we humans didn't know what was up there in the skies. But to find a ballooning spider 15,000 feet in the air, I mean, that's just amazing. And here we are thinking, you know, bugs crawl around us. Maybe they fly a few feet above us. But this is just one example of how insects are pretty spectacular. And I know you two agree because that's why we're doing the show. That's why we have you on.
I love them. They're amazing. And every time I'm out looking at them, I learn something new, which I think is the best part about it. There's just an endless subjects to study and learn about.
You know, and that dispatch from Hugh Raffles, I think is perfect as an introduction, because it really is the case that insects own the place. You know, they invented flight. I mean, so this description of them all over in the skies is so apropos. I mean, they invented powered flight on Earth long before Archaeopteryx, before birds began to fly. So, yeah, they own the place.
You know, you think about, though, the 1910s, 1920s, and all the exploration that was happening, and all the exploration then of the insect world. Is there still stuff in the insect world to discover?
I mean, oh, my gosh, yes. Right now, we think there's about a million insect species named by science.
A million. Just pause on that for a moment. A million species
in the world named.
That's it.
And, well, the estimates of what we're missing from that, which vary widely depending on who makes them, are anywhere from there's probably 2 million, another million to name, up to 30 million species to be named yet. So there is a whole world out there to explore and learn about, and it's not just in exotic places like Panama or the Congo or something like that. It's right here in our backyards. In fact, we're finding new insects all the time right here in North America, in New England, even in places where we think that are well explored.
Kent, have you ever found a new insect?
Not to my knowledge.
Right.
I'd love to. That would be great.
Yeah.
But no.
Brian? There are two ways to look at that. Yes, I've discovered insects that are known to science in Vermont.
You know, but, like, so we not had known never to Vermont.
Seen, right. Yeah. We had never seen them in Vermont. But it's also the case that any one of us might go out and see something that is not yet known or described. It's unlikely, but it's still certainly possible.
Well, and the discoveries to be made, too, are just about not only about who they are, but what are they doing? I mean, we know lots about insects in Vermont, the names of them and what they look like and maybe even the habitat they're in, but we have no idea what they're doing.
Why not? Why are our insects so little studied compared to some other species?
You know, in that book, that tribute to insects, Raffles calls them otherworldly. And I don't agree with them in some respects, you know. I mean, yes, they're different than us. They've got six legs, you know. Many of them have five eyes and these big compound eyes. So they are different from us. But in the same sense, they are probably the most observable and intimate wildlife there is out there in our own backyards. I mean, think about what nature we love. Birds is a great example. They are beautiful, accessible. They sing. They have feathers like angels. But they are somewhat ephemeral and intangible. They fly away from us. Insects are
Are you pitting birds
us.
Against insects
oh,
here?
Yeah,
we're going to have
don't
a fight.
Get me started. I've gotten myself in trouble with this.
Well, and the great thing about insects, too, is that I feel like we're in the heyday of observing them as an average citizen, as like someone just going out in our garden and observing them, because we got amazing tools now to look at them. Not just our eyes, but now we have stuff to accentuate them. We have things like close-focusing binoculars, which sounds ridiculous because we think of binoculars for watching birds. But get yourself a cheap pair of binoculars that can focus on your laces of your shoes and sit by your garden and use those on insects. It opens a whole new world to be able to watch what they're doing close up without them being disturbed. It's amazing.
Right.
And we have iPhones or whatever smartphone you want to use that take incredible pictures close up that we can actually share with each other and learn about the stuff we're actually seeing, which is really great.
And think about how we interact with wildlife. You know, we see birds well sometimes, not well often. You know, every once in a while we'll bump into a moose. We all see white-tailed deer in the state. We see squirrels in our yards. But, you know, insects, the diversity is going to be 10 or 100 or 1,000 times greater, even in your own backyard.
Even in your own kitchen. You don't even have to leave your kitchen.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And so, the thing is you know what? I like to focus to, like, you know, you have lots of folks on here talking about pest insects, ticks and mosquitoes and whatever. And today I like to focus, in my mind, in this show more on the amazing insects that aren't bothering us. Because, you know, we tend to focus on even what we study is the stuff that bugs us or bugs our crops or something. No pun intended. But really, what I love to look at are things that don't really affect us in that way. Maybe even be beneficial to us, which are pollinators and stuff like that. The stuff that's just beautiful and it's not biting my earlobe.
And they can affect us in profound ways.
Yeah.
I mean,
Brian, tell me
more. Well, you know, I've been spending a good portion of my summer chasing rare butterflies in Maine. I'm photographing butterflies for the state of Maine this summer. And it's causing me to rethink the way I look at forests of Maine and places in Maine and even places here in Vermont and where I fit into that picture.
How so?
Well, you know, it's hard to explain. I'll give you maybe an example here is that there's a butterfly called Hessel's Hair Streak. It's this little tiny thing the size of your thumbnail.
Holy
it's
grail.
It's glittery green and brown with these white jagged lightning bolts on its wings.
We lust after it.
It's really rare. And actually, it wasn't really discovered, quote unquote, until the 40s or so when this guy named Sidney Hessel, who I think was like a rubber importer or an investor or something, but also at the time an amateur lepidopterist, started to look at this butterfly, which we had thought was another species, the same as another species that we have here in Vermont called juniper hair streak. Turns out it's a different species. It has a different life history. Its caterpillars eat Atlantic white cedar. Ours in Vermont eat juniper. So they look very similar, but they're really different organisms. And I'd never seen one until this summer when I photographed it. And then I got some really nice photos of it in Maine. And I bushwhacked to a bog in Maine that is a lot like our bogs. They've got black spruce and squishy mats with orchids growing out of them, and they're bouncing around. And I got soaked. And there are these white Atlantic white cedars at the perimeter of this bog. And it's not a tree that we have in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And there were these butterflies. And the only place I could have found them were bogs with Atlantic white cedar. And their relationship with these trees and these trees' position in the landscape caused me to think about life in forests beyond trees, beyond how we simply might also look at black spruce, another tree that we have at high elevation in Vermont and in bogs in Vermont. But in Maine, I was looking for black spruce because I was looking for another butterfly called bog elfin, exceedingly rare, not well photographed in Maine. So I went to places where there were black spruce. And I was in black flies like I've almost never been in before.
You've been in a lot of black flies.
Yeah. But when I found the they were annoying, the black flies, you know. But when I found the bog elfins, I forgot about black flies, and I focused on this little tiny streaky butterfly that not only made me happy, but made me just think about black spruce and think about forests, because we don't normally associate with butterflies with forests. We associate them with our gardens and open meadows. But here are a few butterfly species that eat conifer needles. Most butterfly caterpillars do not eat conifer needles. They eat leafy green plants. So new ways of being outside and looking at the world all through, you know, all on the wing of a butterfly.
Well, listeners, if that doesn't sell you on the idea of thinking of insects as wonderful creatures to be studied, explored, to coexist with at the very least. Granted, if you want to smack that mosquito, I don't have a problem with that. I do it too.
Right.
But you know, think about the wonder here and the colors. Oh, my goodness. Some of the beetles we have around us. And let's go to Caliph, who's calling in from Westford. Hi, Caliph.
Hello. I just wanted to share my experience flying with insects.
Oh, cool.
Oh, awesome.
So I'm a paraglider pilot, which is effectively the world's slowest aircraft. It's a bag of nylon with strings. And I have quite a bit of experience flying with monarch butterflies, both locally and in Mexico, where they winter every year.
I want to do that.
These spiders, not actually the spider, but the webs will get caught in our lines, and you can look up and see an array of spider webs glistening in the sunlight.
Oh, that is great.
And you like that, Caliph? It doesn't sort of creep you out to have spider webs trailing you and catching your face?
No, not at all. They're incredibly thin. If you didn't know what they were, you wouldn't know what it was. It's just like a little bit of an extra light show off the lines, you know, a couple inches long. The 14,000-foot mark has been thrown out. I've seen him 10,000 feet off the ground a number of times riding thermals, and I would say with storms, they probably go to the top of thunderstorms, which I've heard can be, you know, 30 or 40,000 feet.
You know, it strikes me, Jane, that when you were talking about spiders ballooning, that not everybody might know what that means.
Mm. Yeah.
And just to make sure, because you were talking about their spider webs up there, their silk, what the spiders do to, I guess, to disperse is they actually let out a long line of silk until the wind catches it and literally like a balloon pulls them up. And as you said, they ride thermals or wind currents or whatever. They'll climb as high as those take them, sort of at the will of the wind, basically. They really can't control it, as far as I know. So it's really they're riding on a long string of spider web.
Huh. Caliph, thanks for the call. That was fascinating. That's nice, great to hear somebody, you know, here out paragliding and seeing this in person.
Enjoying
now,
insects
so cool.
High up.
I'd love to be up there with a net on a having my insect net while hanging on a paraglider.
Well, I think when I was rereading that chapter from Hugh Raffles, the planes, they stuck something sort of out of the bottom of the plane, and it was like sticky tape. So it was basically at whatever elevation, just, you know, sticking those insects right to it. But, yeah, I would love that, too. I mean, I was just on a flight on Saturday night, and we're up 30,000 feet, and I'm thinking about how high do the birds go, what's up here, and, you know, it just must be amazing to be a pilot of some sort.
This, to me, would be like a dream. I mean, imagine there's that great movie, you know, Fly Away Home, where she, you know, paraglided with the geese, ultralights. I would love to do that with insects.
With monarchs.
Yeah.
You know, that brings me to insect migration, which is, you know, we always talk about monarch migration, but there's a lot of insects that migrate, and we're learning more and more every day about more insects that migrate. And one of the things, if everyone recalls last summer, well, more end of October, we had this amazing migration of
painted ladies.
Painted ladies.
Thank you. Amazing.
They were everywhere.
Yeah.
I was from here to the Gulf of Maine. They were all over the place heading southward, where we don't really know yet. But what is interesting is I, too, was just away, Jane. I was actually just in Italy. And the second butterfly I saw in Italy, I do watch butterflies abroad, too.
Even when you're theoretically on vacation?
Even when I'm on vacation, was a painted lady.
Huh.
And I realized on my hike along the Mediterranean that there was painted ladies all over the place. And it turns out that a study just came out the week after I got home showing that these things are coming from Africa, and they fly the whole way nonstop across the Sahara Desert to arrive on the coast, northern coast of the Mediterranean, and then move further north. So the butterflies I was seeing, the painted ladies I was seeing, had just flown 12,000 kilometers across the Sahara and across the Mediterranean to arrive on the Italian coast.
Wow. So where did the ones that we were seeing in New England
come
from?
Well, in the springtime, we had this great movement of butterflies northward, and they sort of disappeared. And some of my colleagues in Quebec said they were in north-central Quebec, where they probably bred across there. They had a great season there for who knows why, produced a ton of them. Then they shift back southward. They can't handle the cold, so they shifted back southward. We don't really know where they're going yet. We think they're going probably the whole way to Mexico, and that's probably where they come out of in the spring too. So it's this sort of awkward, mystic flush of insects out of Mexico and back into Mexico that we just don't really know how, understand it yet, and we need to do a lot more work.
So painted ladies, we know that we had this sort of bumper crop of them, if you want to call it that, last summer. But what about monarchs? Because there's been a lot of concern over the last few years about monarch butterflies, which of course also make that big migration and are really struggling with habitat and food loss, you know, the milkweed. So what's going on with them?
Well, here in the Northeast, we only represent about somewhere around 10 to 15% of the monarch population when they reach Mexico came from the Northeast. So it's not a lot of the monarchs here that we're responsible for, but we do have a lot of monarchs here sometimes. And last year was a great example. I felt like, Brian, I don't know if you agree, but I felt like last year was an above-average year here for monarchs.
Indeed.
But the weird thing happened is even though we had an above-average year, when time came to migrate, it was really hot here all across the north. And it stayed that way for a long time. It actually delayed the monarchs' migration. They hung out here far longer than I ever recall. I haven't, you know, tallied the records yet for dates, but it went on to a ridiculously late date in the fall until they finally were booking out of here. And then they ran into some tropical storms, some hurricanes. They had problems going southward. And the mid-season tally in Mexico, where they fly over the forests of Mexico and they look down and they actually count the size of the monarch populations down there by area, because there's millions of them, so they can't hand count them, obviously. So it's by hectares.
That would be fun. I'd like that job.
Yeah. All summer you're going to count by hand. So what they do is they measure the size that they're covering in the trees as they're hanging there. And this year, again, it was down by about 14 or 15% from 2016. And there's been a trend for the last 3 years, once again, of going down. So we're down to, what, I think it was 2.5 hectares they're covering last year. Now, when my daughter was born 20-some-odd years ago in 1996, there was 80% more monarchs. So they were in the billions, and now we're counting them in the millions.
And is that reversible? Could we reverse that trend?
That's the million-dollar question. If you could answer that, you can leave your job here, Jane, and become a lepidopterist. But there's a lot of theories about what is causing this. It could be when they arrive in Texas in the spring and there's drought, which had been back then, there was bad drought times in Texas. Maybe that's it. Is it, as you mentioned, loss of milkweed in the Midwest, the breadbasket of monarchs, the milkweed, because of a massive crop of corn that has no weeds in it now because of weed killer? Or is it in the fall when they're migrating back, weird weather on the migrations back, migrating too late, so they arrive with lack of nectar to nectar on? No one really knows. And honestly, in any given year, some of those ideas and all of them may come into play. It's just, I think, a general degradation of the monarch's home range. And I don't think we'll ever be able to point a smoking gun at it. We've got to do something about all these things to make them come back.
You know, it occurs to me that I did quit my job and become a lepidopterist. I went to work for you, Kent. You know, I was just a journalist.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're joined by conservation biologist Kent McFarland and writer and naturalist Brian Pfeiffer, and they're helping us explore the insect world all around us. And let's go to Lorraine, who's calling in from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Lorraine.
Hello, bug guys. Glad to hear you. I have two things I want to talk about. I found this emerald green beetle in my garden back in April, this spring, and it was just scurrying around. I hope it eats flea beetles. And then last year I had some chard and I was having leaf miners, which I understand there's a moth that lays the eggs. And I had a batch of chard that was near a big leafy catnip plant, and I noticed there were all these webs, and there weren't as many leaf miners, and in the webs there were little moths. So that spider was working for me. And it was also bright green.
Huh.
Any ideas?
Lorraine, thanks for that. I'm going to tag team here, and we got a note from Brynna, who sent us a picture and says it's a beautiful emerald green beetle. And she says, I checked to make sure it wasn't an emerald ash borer. It's not. Is it possibly a tiger beetle? It's beautiful enough to wear as a pin if it wouldn't move. So we have Lorraine and Brynna both wondering about green beetles here. I'll share Brynna's picture with you.
Yeah, that is the one the one that awesome. Brynna sent in is called six-spotted tiger beetle. It's Cicindela sexgutata, and it's the most common tiger beetle that we have. You'll see them scurrying on sandy roads or even in your garden.
And they are brilliant green.
They do.
Really
they
beautiful.
Are this sort of that just glows emerald green with these little white spots around the perimeter of the elytra.
And if you look at them, get down on your hands and knees without scaring them if you can, or use your close focusing binoculars, you can look at them and see that they have these massive mandibles, these huge jaws on the front of them. They are amazing predators. They will jump on things from a distance and chew them right up. I don't know, Brian, is that why they're called tiger beetles? They're ferocious predators?
They often have, other than those spots, they have other, like, striped maculations. There's maybe about 15 or 16 or 17 of these tiger beetle species in Vermont.
Huh. And Lorraine also is seeing a green spider that's eating the moths that might otherwise get to her chard.
You know, here's the thing. Right, I am, like, spider illiterate, and it's embarrassing. But in my defense, we don't even have a good list of the species of spiders that exist in Vermont. There is no fauna list for Vermont.
Really?
Yeah, they're really understudied. I don't know what kind of spider this is, but I had the exact same thing happen to me 2 days ago when I was watching moths in my back deck, and I was using a couple of leaves to put the moths on to take pictures of them, and there was this beautiful green spider on a leaf, and I took a picture of it and have not ID'd it yet.
All right, so here's a question then for people like Lorraine or those of us who find an insect and think, this is beautiful or this is interesting or this is weird. I would like an ID, and I don't have Kent and Brian's home phone numbers. So what do people like us do?
Here's the great thing, and I'd love to plug this because it's so fun.
Good thing I asked them.
I know. iNaturalist Vermont is a project that we help run. If you just go into your browser and type in iNaturalist, you'll get to it. Or you can download the free app for your smartphone. You can take a picture of just about anything in Vermont that's even reasonably common. It sends that picture basically to California, to the iNaturalist headquarters. It takes about 2 seconds for it to analyze the photograph and come back with a suggestion of what that organism might be. And if it doesn't know, it'll say, you know what? We don't really know. We're unsure. Or it'll say, we're pretty sure it's this. You can try it out. It works for plants, insects.
It's scary.
All
kinds. This is AI, machine learning,
it's
or
machine
whatever
learning.
It is.
I mean, it's so amazing. The great thing is there's hundreds of us doing this now in Vermont, and we have over 250,000 records now in the database. The more data that goes in and is identified by someone like Brian and I as actual organism, it uses that to learn more. So it's teaching itself day in, day out how to better analyze these photographs and give you the answer to what the ID is.
It's going to put us out of work.
Then you have to be journalists.
If it doesn't, if it doesn't know what it is, it's a little bit it's kind of a little bit Facebookish. People that are other naturalists in the state can look at it. Some of them, like Brian or myself, who are experts in certain places, will look at it. Even some of them there's a bee expert from the American Museum of Natural History. He looks at every single bee that someone puts in there. It's amazing. So there's experts and just amateur experts out there every day. Instead of watching TV, they're watching the data come in and analyzing the data and putting IDs on it. And they'll help you learn why they ID'd it that way. So I've been in a great conversation with people like, well, the reason it's this kind of butterfly and not that one is because of X, Y, and Z. And so it's a learning experience for everyone, too. Not just a data gathering spot. So
what I love about that is sometimes I will find a moth, for example, or a beetle, and I'll think, I want to know what this is. And I do an internet search, and I'm trying to put in, like, green beetle, you know. And you get things that are never quite what it is. So the difference here is that you put it in, and then you get told what it is, rather than having to do all the search and weed out things.
Exactly. And if it if it doesn't know, it basically tells you, we're not really sure, or it gives you a list of, like, here's 10 possibilities, we're not super sure.
Yeah, and this is crowdsourcing at its best for the person who posts the photo to learn. And we love, for whatever reason, we like to put names on nature. You know, it's like we think, therefore we are, we name nature, therefore we know it and experience it more and better. And then it's also great for us because we learn things about the diversity of Vermont. And it just sort of part of our heritage to know what's here. And we're still learning, and it's, anyone can contribute to our this sort of bank of knowledge and this bank of wisdom that we're having about what lives here.
True story, last year, a fly fisherman put a dragonfly picture in iNaturalist, didn't know what it was.
He just listed dragonfly.
Brian Pfeiffer saw the dragonfly on there and was like, oh, my gosh.
I spit up my coffee.
This is a new record for Vermont. This dragonfly has never been seen here. He was just taking a picture of a pretty dragonfly, but Brian, the expert, happened to be there. He was ecstatic. Brian was super ecstatic. And we now know that there's probably a new population of dragonflies in Vermont. So really cool.
We got a, speaking of things that might be a record, we also got a note from Jim, who says he emailed a photo of a Missumena vitia female spider, also known as the goldenrod crab spider, grasping her prey. It's a honeybee.
Oh, yeah.
And he says there's also a black fly on the honeybee. And he writes, I found this hunter in our raspberry patch 2 weeks ago. According to spider.com, this will be the first recorded photographed spider of this species. She's in Vermont. Please verify they're able to change color depending on the environment. And again, I'll show you the picture that he sent here. It's a little bit small.
Yeah, that's great.
Beautiful,
I'm surprised
white
that
spider.
Yeah. We'd send that to iNaturalist. We can be certain about the idea. That the thing about insects is the diversity is astounding. Like if there are fireflies happening right now, for example. It's been great. And you know what? This hot, humid day today.
Perfect.
Fireflies are going to be. Oh yeah. You know. Get ready for some mosquitoes, but also get out there and watch the show. I got home from Maine on Saturday night really late, and I got out of the truck, and my backyard was like a glittering galaxy of stars, you know, right there in the yard. The point I was going to make is that there's not just one of anything. You know, there are probably like 15 or 20 different firefly species in Vermont. So these crab spiders, they're pretty easy to ID. Posted on iNaturalist, and we'll be certain about it. But that's the amazing thing. I mean, the diversity is great. There's probably in your yard right now at least two or three firefly species marauding about and flashing each other and having a big orgy in your yard right now.
And, you know, if you want to learn more about fireflies, Kent and Brian were both on an episode of the kids podcast that we have here at VPR called But Why? Last year, so it was last summer, we have a link to it we'll post on the Vermont Edition page. But you talked about firefly communication and how humans can try to mimic the firefly. If you figure out what signal, what pattern the firefly is sending out, you might actually be able to get it to talk to you. It's the males that are doing the signaling, right?
Yeah, the males are flying around, and different firefly species have males have specific flash patterns. They're signaling females. And the females are usually in the grass, sitting there in the shrubs, and they signal back to the males. The males see that flash, and they'll come into it. There is this sort of... Should we talk about that? I'll mention two kinds of fireflies. One is in the genus Photinus, and one is in the genus Photurus.
Easily confused.
Right. They flash slightly different colors. The Photurus are kind of greenish, and the Photinus are kind of yellowish. But,
duh.
Yeah. But, get this. The female Photurus fireflies, they imitate the flash of a female Photinus. So what she does is she sees a Photinus flying around, and she mimics a Photinus flash. And he comes in. He thinks he's going to get lucky and, you know, have a copulation. But instead,
he gets eaten.
She basically kills him.
Oh, really?
Because he's got defensive chemicals that she doesn't have. So she eats him for defense against predators. And occasionally he can use his chemicals.
Wait. Kleptochemistry?
Yeah, it is. It is exactly that.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Occasionally, before he gets eaten, he might emit his own defense to gum up her mandibles so she can't eat him. But yeah, this is the classic case of a firefly femme fatale. You know, the male thinks he's going to get lucky, and she kills him and eats him.
Wow.
Cool story. I just hate it when that happens.
No, you don't. You'd have nothing to study if you didn't. Right. What a cool story to have.
Yeah.
Andrew in Barton emailed in, almost as fascinating as waiting for monarchs is finding all the other life on milkweed. It harbors so many bug species. And this might be a good opportunity for us to talk about how, you know, you think of these one species of insect that is sort of the one we think of that's tied to something like the milkweed. So we think of milkweed and monarch. But obviously, there are other things that eat milkweeds, too. Or we think of now emerald ash borer beetles, which have been found in Vermont. We're still trying to figure out exactly where they are. The state is studying it. But there are other things that also rely on ash trees. And so as we see what happens with emerald ash borer beetles, this could have an effect on other insect populations, right?
Yeah. In fact, just the other day in our office, we were talking about this. There's a bunch of biologists sitting around eating our peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And someone said, hey, you know what? What happens if we lose all these ash trees? What else is eating ash trees that's native to here? And we thought we were on to something new. And, of course, one of our colleagues down at UConn had already thought about this and went and figured out in North America what are all the insect species that feed on Fraxinus, the genus for ash trees, and came up with a paper. And we were ecstatic. I haven't gone through to find out what is in Vermont. But the shocking thing is that a lot of them are moths. And some of them are these big moths that we love. Why am I spacing
this? Giant silk moths.
No, not giant silk moths. Oh, there's
what
too many insects.
Gramia, other genera of moths.
Yeah, the gramias.
Oh, really?
There's tons of them, right?
Yeah.
So there's 10 species that totally rely on Fraxinus that would disappear without them. So goes the tree, so goes the insects. There's a bunch of beetles. There's a lot of stuff that relies on that one and only that tree.
Who cares, though?
Well, I do.
No,
that's a good point.
You know, I will just say briefly that if you want birds in your backyard, you know, you could put bird seed out. The best thing to do is to put plants out that attract insects. You know, like if you want wildlife in your backyard, what you want is you want animals that convert plant tissue into protein. And insects do that like no other animals. They chew on leaves. Caterpillars chew on leaves. And the birds eat the caterpillars. Birds don't eat leaves. They eat seeds and fruits and other insects. So if you want birds, you should raise insects in your yard.
Hawk moth. That's what I was trying to come up with.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
9 species of hawk moth rely on this. And hawk moths are huge pollinators. We forget that moths and flies and all these things. We think about bees all the time. But moths and flies are huge pollinators, too. That's totally true, Brian. I mean, we have the breadbasket of songbirds here breeding. We've got these beautiful warblers that migrate here and sing and breed here, and I love them. And they wouldn't be here without moths because their diet to their chicks is mostly moth larvae.
Yeah, these
and so without this giant flush of moths in our northern forests, we do not have all these beautiful warblers and thrushes around. It just doesn't happen.
Speaking of larvae, I keep bees. My husband and I keep bees, and he was telling me we were looking at them. We opened them up yesterday to see how they're doing, and we also have bears. And it turns out the bears, you've always thought, you know, they want the honey, right? But they really want the larvae, right?
Yeah.
Because that is that really, really rich protein source.
Yeah.
Is that
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Exactly.
We're spending the full hour today talking bugs. Yes, the full hour, mostly because our guests, Brian Pfeiffer and Kent McFarland, are so entertaining. But
it's
also,
not that we talk too much?
Well, that too. We would only get one answer in if we did a regular-sized segment. But also because so many people have questions and ideas and photos and stories that they want to share with you and with us and with our listeners. And let's go to Margaret, who's calling in from Connecticut. Hi, Margaret. You're on the air.
Hi. So I was at the top of Mount Washington last week, and so it was about 6,000 feet of elevation, but it was like 2,000 feet above tree line. And so it was like way above tree line, and there weren't any animals other than these black spiders. And I was wondering what those spiders were and how they survived in such a harsh condition.
Were these spiders on the rocks? Were they like crawling all over the rocks?
Yeah, they were like these black spiders that were crawling all over the rocks, and they were only this one kind.
Yeah. So on top of Mount Washington, it's like being up in the Arctic. It's like going way further north. And those spiders up there are an actual Arctic spider. It's a kind of wolf spider up there that wanders all over the rocks looking for insects that have blown in from down below. So they actually live up there, and they feed mostly off of insects, I think, that just arrive there sort of by accident. They've flown up on the winds. They've gotten up on the hilltop maybe to show off to other insects. And then there's these wolf spiders crawling over the rocks. And you can find rock piles up there that have these things all over them. And I, you know what's amazing is that you actually noticed that.
That's
amazing.
Great.
Because most people don't notice cool things like that.
Yeah, and that she hiked up Mount Washington. Way to go, Margaret.
Yeah, and there are two. Kent, you've studied them. You've done work up there on Mount Washington. There are two rare butterflies up there that that Margaret would see if she were up there
another month
in the summer. Yeah.
There's two rare butterflies. They only exist there unless you drive north again by several thousand miles northward. They're kind of stuck on Mount Washington because that's where they've been since glaciation time.
All right. I see another hike in your future, Margaret. Thank you for the call. That's excellent. Let's go to Andy, who's calling in from Norwich. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. That previous caller was very astute because she had part of my question and just a topic discussion in that I took several courses from E.O. Wilson, who you know well, and talked about speciation to uninhabited islands where he gassed some groves in the Florida groves, but also looking at volcanic eruptions and how they get speciated through ballooning and other forms of speciation.
Yeah, Krakatoa. And
more recently, in the 70s, the island that was created off of Iceland and other places are great spots to study, and that this occurs within our ecosystems, too. Things get blown around and distributed, like you were discussing, and that Mount Washington is a prime example of a biogeography of that very nature, of an isolated area that can only receive things like the young lady noticed.
Yeah,
I thought
that's
this
right.
Is a very interesting point.
It is.
And that there's more to forest than just what we see.
Yeah, really, Andy, indeed. Thanks for the call. That's cool.
That's great.
You know, we've been talking about the insects in flight and how high they go. And what I was learning was that the stronger flyers, the ones that can really fly on their own, tend to be lower. So they're using wind, but in a less they're less reliant on it. And the things like the ballooning spiders, which can't actually fly,
right.
They're using those wind gusts at higher elevations and really just letting themselves be carried in that way. And then so they are getting to these places like these islands, these new islands.
And then get this. There's a dragonfly we've talked about before in years past, this thing called Pantala flavescens. It's called wandering glider. It's on every continent except Antarctica. They cross oceans. And they've actually been, there's a pretty good hypothesis and some pretty good evidence that they may fly over the Himalayas.
Whoa.
That's how high they can get. And if they're crossing oceans, they may be able to prey on what we call aerial plankton, you know, insects or ballooning spiders out there floating around over the oceans.
That is so cool.
Oh, man.
So we got a note from Steve in Barrie who wants to know, what is the deal with cluster flies? Where do they come from? And Steve says, I was doing renovation last fall in a place that was infested. We would vacuum every morning, but it never made a difference. Often on a chilly, clear morning, I would see flies completely motionless on the floor. By 10 a.m., I would see these flies beginning to spin on the floor like jacks. By 11, they had again taken flight, busily bumping into the windows. Do they ever die?
This is actually a fly that overwinters as an adult. They enter your house in the fall through any crack they can find. Then in the spring, they don't do much over the winter. They don't eat things. They really don't do what flies do very much in the winter.
And then I.e. fly.
Fly or defecate or, you know, lay eggs. They will try to get out once it warms up in March and April. They will get out, and I believe they will lay an egg on the surface of the soil. And I think there's a red worm that figures in their biology and the larval biology of these things. So it's a bit of a cycle going on that involves the worms in your soil and your house as a refuge in the wintertime.
I'm going to also see if we can post in the section of our webpage for today's show that says related content. We're going to post a link to Steve Zinn's story of many years ago now, 8 or 9 years ago. It was sort of an ode to the clusterfly. I think it won a National Murrow Award. It's the best writing and the most interesting story you have ever heard, not just about a clusterfly, because I'm sure you've heard many interesting stories about clusterflies, but really a superb story, superb writing, and really interesting.
All right.
So
okay,
we'll post that as well.
That's the thing about insects. It's not only about the insects. It's about our relationship to them.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, you said you didn't want to talk about pests, and I have studiously avoided talking about pests and how we get rid of ticks, because we have done and will do more of that, and mosquitoes. But, you know, a lot of our relationship to insects is that pest or, you know, predator-prey relationship, and we're sort of both predator and prey in this scenario. You know, you think about things like mosquitoes, and they prey on us, but we certainly try to kill as many of them as possible. So you're trying to stem this tide of thinking of these insects as pests, but that seems like a hard sell when our interactions with them often are of the stingy kind.
I think it is a hard sell. You know, I recognize that this isn't for everyone. You know, like I'm out thrashing around the woods so I can get to a bog to find rare butterflies. But you know what's really amazing is that in your own yard is diversity beyond belief. And if it just comes down to looking at these little green beetles or looking at these orange and black butterflies in the yard, hey, it's a start. You'll be hooked.
Yeah, I have a tiny little pollinator garden in my yard. We're talking 10 feet long, 5 feet wide. It's small. And it's kind of, I call it a pollinator garden, but my wife calls it a jungle. It's a little in disarray. But you know what? Insects love that. And I love to hang out there some mornings with a cup of coffee, sitting in a chair, literally just watching what's going on in there with insects. Again, with my close-focusing binoculars, but I could do it just with my eyes. And I challenge anyone, grab a cup of Joe or something and just hang out for a half hour watching a patch like that right out your back door. You will see stuff happen that you're like, oh, wow. Oh, what's that? Your brain will start – your brain will go on fire. It'll start thinking about all this stuff that's going on, and it'll go beyond insects. It'll be go beyond – what they are to go be what's your relationship with them. It'll
well, like
happen.
Brian was talking about.
Yeah, it'll happen.
And well, and Bridget Butler, the bird diva, talks about slow birding. So we could add slow insect watching to that
yeah.
as well.
It's absolutely true. You know, we are distracted by so many things these days. And it's very easy, actually, to watch these things on your glowing screen. But don't, you know, watch them because we will have them until winter. And again, I just think it's wildlife that is around us, and there are discoveries to be made and beauty to be seen and brutality and subterfuge and just about anything you can imagine all played out on a stage in your yard.
Well, so Lynette emailed in to say, I was over the moon last summer when for the first time I found painted lady babies on my native pussy toes.
Oh, nice.
I got to get to know and recognize them and had the great good fortune to get a picture of five of them on my flower and garlic chives. I keep checking the pussy toes, but so far no luck this season. But there's Lynette. I mean, you do form a relationship when you see these things in person, right? And then you have this sense of wonder and sense of...
Where are they?
Yeah. And also a sort of a sense of ownership. In a weird way, like, oh, these are mine and I want to protect them. And isn't that what conservation is about in some ways, is having an experience with these animals and then you actually have more of an incentive or more of a desire to do the conservation work.
And this sort of our connection and our observation of nature, it's been in our genome for thousands and thousands of generations of humanity. We've been with nature. We're losing touch with it. And this is just a great opportunity to get it back.
Well, I could go on for another hour. Why don't we just blow out the next show and we'll do another hour on
this? Why not? Let's do it.
But for now, I've been told by my producers that's not possible. Okay, fine. So we'll say goodbye for now, but we will have another insect show. And boy, it's really entertaining to talk to you, and that enthusiasm is so infectious. Brian Pfeiffer is a writer and field naturalist and an adjunct faculty member in the field naturalist program at UVM. Kent McFarland is a conservation biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies and co-host of VPR's Outdoor Radio. Thanks so much to both of you. Really fun.
You're welcome.
Thanks
Jane.
A lot, Jane.